thing where you just
come
let the
on,
camera...
Come on, that's what I was doing my thing. I just caught you. How's it going?
It's going great. So, we're with Sarah Ford today. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
So, let's start with you telling us who you are and what you do and what your title is.
All right, so I'm Sarah Ford. I am a program manager for the Visual Studio team, and I'm on the customer connection team. And what I've been doing for the past year and a half, almost 2 years now, is running the Power Toys for Visual Studio. And we look at the top most suggested, most voted customer suggestions that come in for the Visual Studio 2005 product. And we look at them and say, can we provide a solution, a workaround to that suggestion? We can't touch product bits because then we'll be servicing, and we can't issue a service pack update. You know, our team of five people, we can't do something like that. But what we can do is use the extensibility model and provide a solution like a power toy or a tool, something that will ease that pain point, or you know, do something to unblock that adoption blocker. But that's the main goal. But the secondary goal was, can we do it as open source? Can we provide the sources? And can we take in contributions? Can we get contributions in so early that we can not only influence the design of these power toys, but actually learn how to influence the design of the product? So we've been doing that for the past year and a half on Coplex, our new open source site that replaces Got.net.
Very cool.
Yes.
Very cool.
Can you give us an example of a couple of power toys you guys have deployed or implemented?
Oh, yeah, sure. So one of the top, I think it was a top 10 request. Yeah, it was definitely a top 10, was the MSB tool. It allows people who use Visual Studio 2005 to target .NET Framework 1.1. Because with Visual Studio 2005, you're using the .NET Framework 2.0. But maybe you want all the great new IntelliSense features, so you want the new shell. But you still got to support your backwards capability. And so our add-in to MS Build, called MSB, that was just our little cute code name for it, allows you to target through that backwards compatibility. So we were able to provide a solution. And the best part is we also gave out the sources as open source. So you could actually collaborate with us, give us code contributions, things like that.
So are you working with early adopters at all for the next version of Visual Studio, or are you more about the shipping product and doing workarounds for that?
So for our charter, we were looking at aftermarket solutions. But that's a good point. That was something I hadn't considered, was what could we have done for 2008, getting people excited and pumped up. I had some ideas about, like, with an MVP program around shared source, open source, could we have, like, some early adopters in that way influence what comes out next. But pretty much for 2005, we were looking at the Product Feedback Center, which is now called Connect, where any developer who uses Visual Studio can go in, raid, or report a bug, and it goes directly into our internal database. So it's very cool how you can bring the community into the product itself.
So having this mission or goal, I guess, of doing it all as open source, what's the reaction been like internally? Have you had any resistance? Have customers been really pleased?
Well, I laugh when you say how's the reaction been internally, because I started this kind of this quest when I started doing this, you know, it was something new. You asked me 2 years ago, hey, what do you think about open source, shared source? I would just, like, look at you. Sorry, I don't have any experience with that. So it's been great. It's been trying to learn, cover new ground, new territory, not only from a technology perspective. What does it mean to do from a project management of how do you develop code in a collaborative setting? Because here internally, when you have a dedicated team, I can say, like, as a manager, you will do feature X and you will do feature Y. When it's like an open source project, how do you tell people, hey, get this done here? There's no... unlike internally, you can't hold people accountable for doing stuff. It's all about getting... That's why they call it code gifts. It's like, hey, awesome, thank you for that code thing. So that code contribution. So that not only was it interesting to do it from a technology perspective and also from a project management perspective, what's very interesting is it's Microsoft. And so it just adds a whole new dimension to it. What does open source mean at Microsoft? And so I've been like this kid in the candy store, you know, because I get to go and figure out so many different aspects. There's so many different opinions. There's just so many different ways we could do things. And over the past year, I've worked extensively with our legal department to come up with a framework on how do we get things out and what are the questions that you need to ask. And that was very, very cool. My little joke is I kind of camped out with them for the last 3 months of the 6 month project. And it's like, you're going to explain to me your world, explain to me what keeps you up at night so I can figure out what do we need, what questions do we need to ask. And so we came up with this framework, this very, very dev action oriented of what do you need to do. And so it was very cool. That was one of like my most proudest moments. That cool. And making Visual Studio 2005 accessible for those who are blind.
Oh.
That was my first. That's also what I did.
Tell us about that.
Okay. So my first 4.5 years of Microsoft. Oh, I should mention that today is year number 6 plus 1 day. I just made 6 years.
Congratulations.
Nice. Good job.
Yeah, yesterday. It's so funny. It's like my poor little 5-year crystal, it got chipped. And so it's like, does that mean that I'm really that jaded that my crystal is chipped? And jaded too. So I've been in DevDiv or Visual Studio for the past 6 years. First 4.5, I was a SDET, a software tester. So I wrote not only the automation framework on how we're going to test Visual Studio, but also all the test cases, all the actual testing on Visual Studio itself, because it's a development environment. In order to test a development environment, you've got to be able to write code. And if you're already writing the code, then you can also do the automation framework too. So lots of testing, lots of coding worked on as a 3 versions of the shell. So when I first got here, it was September, obviously, 6 years ago. 1 month later, I get this email, hey, we need someone to do some accessibility testing. And I'm like, I don't know anything about accessibility. And this is kind of like where I found out that I like going down new paths, being like a trailblazer. And I said, okay. They gave me the list of things to check. And I was like, what's a screen reader thing? I don't know. I've never used a screen reader before. And they said, yeah, if you're blind or have low vision, you might use a screen reader to read the contents of the screen to you. Because when you're blind or have low vision, it's not about... Because a lot of people think it's a keyboard, like where would you find things? Well, as long as you're using the same keyboard, you know the region. It's the contents on the screen. You could use a Braille display, but you only get 65 characters, and they get extremely expensive to use. So lots of people use a screen reader. And so we're like, well, how do we test using a screen reader? And the program manager at the time said, well, turn off your monitor. And so for the next 3 months, I did. I wish we had gotten video of it. But I got pretty good at using Visual Studio without the monitor. I could do a lot of daily functions without using the monitor. And then I would have like what I call the screen reader dreams, because you would just have this voice talk to you all the time. And then you would have these nightmares of this voice. Instead of having images, it would be these sounds. So yeah, so for 3 months I didn't use a monitor, and to understand how to, how does a blind person, how would they use program. And my quick little success story was the first time I ever met someone on campus who was blind. He's like, oh, I'll turn down the rate of speech for my screen reader, because you don't want to hear Microsoft Development Environment. You speed it up to Microsoft Development Environment, left bracket design, right bracket dev, start page. I did a lot. And so I was like, he's like, oh, I'll turn it down. I was like, nah, don't turn it down. You know, I use mine at like 115. And the look on his face was like, what? You actually really use it. And I knew I had to like enter this community, this world, that they would always have my back, because I really was trying to make a difference. So I did that. I drove that effort. Every dotted I and crossed T, I did a lot of work on that. And that's when I was originally on Channel 9 for some of the accessibility stuff. So you can see some of those earlier videos. And I did that for 3 years. And yeah, it was great giving talks at conferences on this is the improvements that we're making to the shell on how you can use a screen reader. And here I am giving demos. It's hard enough to do a demo with just, you know, the product that you're demoing, because, you know, it's always played with what's going to go wrong. But I was also using a third-party tool, a screen reader, to do the demo. And yeah, so I survived that. So those are my some of my things with accessibility in the first 3 years. And then I had my day job, which was testing the shell. And I did this crazy tour of all of Visual Studio, of the environment. So I owned our VS SDK, which was called VSIP at the time, the extensibility model, the core IDEs, so like window management and some of the tool windows, and sometimes I would help with the help system. Then I moved to the editor, did that for a while, and then I ended up with Project Solution before I came here. So I did a complete tour. And now I'm running the Tip of the Day series because I kept on finding, like, oh, I didn't know about that. Oh, I didn't know about that. So now I'm going back and looking through all of, like, the various, yeah, I didn't know about this keyboard shortcut. And so every day there's a new tip out there.
What's your favorite tip this month?
This one for the month. See, I'm actually posting them. It's actually January 2nd right now. That's why I have, like, a snowman. I'm from New Orleans, so I don't know what snow looks like or how to draw it. So that was my best guess. Yeah. So, and each one has a picture, so that's kind of film my snowman. Yeah, so it has something to do with, that tip is going to be about the tool window speed.
What's this?
That was someone else's attempt at a snowman, and it eventually became some type of, like...
Soccer ball?
It's not a soccer ball. It started as a snowflake, and then we thought it was looking like a stained glass structure, so we started coloring it in, and now I think it's something from a Lara Croft movie.
Very interesting.
Wow.
It's my favorite tip. What is one that I just did recently? Usually, my favorite tips are, like, the short keyboard shortcuts, like Control-W. Well... whatever that does. Select the word or kill the word or delete the word. And then everyone will comment on it. Like, you get, like, 5 or 6 comments about how this is wrong or why I want that one. Or I want it this way. I know it is. Normally when you type in Visual Studio and you want to jump to a line, you hit Control-G. This is today's tip. The little go-to dialog box pops up and you type in a number and hit enter. There's actually a way to do it without the dialog box popping up. You go to the search bar, Control D window, we call it, but Control D will jump to this little find combo box or a search bar in the tool window. And if you type in a number and then hit Control G, it would actually go to the line. There's a bunch of hidden commands, and they're not really hidden, they're just either not on MSDN or you wouldn't know to look on MSDN for it. And there's a bunch of those things with the fine window that I've been blogging about. So that was today. So it's kind of like a silly little thing, but it's actually kind of, I don't know, kind of interesting when you think you know a lot about the show, and then you find out, oh, I never knew that. And so that's why I'm trying to get that, hey, I never knew you could do that. There's a little fun stuff.
Excellent.
Cool. So what did you do before you came to Microsoft?
Oh, I was a college kid.
You were?
Where? College kid? Yeah.
Tulane?
No, not Tulane. Mississippi State.
So Bulldogs.
Yes.
Why don't you sound like you're from the South? You sound like you're from New York.
Yeah,
I hear that
a lot.
Sound
like Philadelphia.
I actually, and then when I finally went to Boston, they were like, no, you're from the South. New Orleans. Now and then I'll slip into a New Orleans accent, and I'll say something like, door, car. Yeah, it'll slip, but it's New Orleans, because it's a port city, just like Boston in New York are port cities. They have that type of dialect, but since it's in the South, there's a Southern twist to it.
I see.
So, but interesting enough, when I was in college, my senior year, I worked for a project called WebTop, where we simulated physics lab experiments in VRML. And so I worked for this physics professor, and he would come in and say, like, okay, this module is going to be a laser. And instead of going physically to the lab and using a laser itself to see the wavelength and the colors change in on the board, you could actually do the lab experiment over the web. And so we a lot of computer graphics involved in that. I was a CS math double major, so I love computer graphics. So I got to code all that up, and we used Visual J++. Mm-hmm. First time ever using Windows, because, you know, I'm a college kid. I'm using, you know, Red Hat and having my friends help me get it installed and go into FreshMeat.net. So here I am using Windows. I'm like, why doesn't LS work? Why can't? How do I find, like, anything in Windows? When I got here, it's like, what's a registry? But yeah, I used Visual J++, and so I had no idea about, like, 98% of the shell. I had no idea you could dock a tool window, because no one ever showed me, so why would I ever know or need to look it up? Mm-hmm. And so that's where a lot of, like, my community passion and my tip of the day, why am I driving myself insane with all these tips and tricks about Visual Studio, because I know what it's like to have this rich, vibrant community in one area, like when I'm using my laptop for personal use or for college, you know, I could go to, like, FreshMeat.net, I could go to ThinkGeek.com, I could go to, or SourceForge, I could go to all these sites and get whatever I'm looking for. But then at work, it's like, I remember a friend saying, you got a question, you could go to the news groups, because I actually had a bug in J++ that was driving me nuts. And the current statement every time I stepped in or out of function would offset by one. And then they would offset by two the next time I jumped in. And it, I had to actually keep down a piece of paper. Okay, I'm off by one now, off by two now, just so you know. And I wanted to report it. But when I went to the Microsoft site to report the issue, said, you know, give Microsoft your credit card and it will charge $250 to your account. I'm like, $250, that's my rent. And it's like, And then it's like, if we can prove it's a bug. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't sacrifice my rent for this trouble that I'm having. And wow. I'm like, that's it. I'm going to have to just keep a tally. And I remember a friend like, oh, you could go to the news group, so no one checks them anyway. So being on this team, with like being on a community team that encourages the development teams to respond in a timely manner to customer bugs that come in through Connect, to answer questions in a timely manner on the forums, to give out, to be the advocate, to say, or the internal evangelist to go around saying, give out your source code, give out your source code. You know, I'm coming from a world where I understood here's a community, and not to have a community for what I was trying to do. So that's where like all my passion comes from, because I remember what that was like, and I want to make sure that all knowledge is, there's a way to share it if you want to share something.
That's cool.
So that's my 6 years in the box, or my little wrap up.
So you said double math and CS major?
Yeah, so as a computer science and mathematics major.
So were you always interested in that as a young girl? Tell us about that. How'd you get into it?
How did I get into it? When I was 5 or 6, my mom brought home a... when I was 5 or 6, she got me a TI-994A home personal computer. And so I first started tweaking with it and having no fear because I didn't know you could break stuff or whatever. I would just play with it. And they had some educational games and they had some, more of like the video style games. And that's when I started realizing I really like math and just tweaking with that. And then later on, she got me a computer from work she was able to bring home, which was like, God, it was one of those you turn it on, it takes 5 minutes to boot. And but there was like this one game for the TI. It was all reading. It was a role-playing game, but it was all based, like it was all text. And it was kind of like a choose your own adventure style, one of those type of one of those flavors of games. It was called a Pirate's Adventure, and I could never beat it because I couldn't really read. I was only like 6, 7 years old, and they always had to help me read. And so you would be in a setting and like, well, open the refrigerator. And like, there is no refrigerator. You can only do what's in the what the description says. I was like, but you're in the kitchen. Why can't you open the refrigerator? Or whatever the scene was. And people would just, my family would get frustrated. And then one day in college, I'm like, you know, there's emulators now. I wonder if I can find that game. And I found the game. I beat the game. And of course, I contacted the person. And it's like, oh, by the way, I finally beat this game. This is actually what got me into it. Because it was so fascinating. Like, I can't let this game beat me. I know I can beat it. It really intrigued me. So I really started getting computers with that. But the biggest thing that really like got my attention, especially with computer graphics, was, you know, not only video games, because, you know, playing Nintendo, but it was the Final Fantasy series. Like, Final Fantasy II, I named my dog, my short-haired collie, after the main character, Cecil. And, but yeah, it goes again to that role-playing game, that style. But now you have not only just text, but you have a visual layout. And so the idea of, like, the storyline to the Final Fantasy series, especially to that game, it was very intriguing. And I was just like, this is what I want to do. I want to build these things. I want to build these games. And, or, like, something with computer graphics. I want to do stuff like that. So, but the high school I went to, they didn't really offer any computer programming courses. They had one for Pascal, and it conflicted with my, this sophomore year, it conflicted with whatever in the schedule, and I really, really wanted to take it, and this shows a lot about my personality. So, I don't know how I thought of this, why I thought of this. I guess I was just really angry, and then when I get mad and upset, I try to think of ways to, like, beat the game, beat the system. So I took the Algebra 2 book, and over the next, like, 5 weeks or 5 weekends, I finished every problem in the book. And right or wrong, who cares? But, you know, I finished every problem. And I had, like, these two huge 5-subject notebooks. And I came back to, like, class and didn't tell anyone I was doing this. I just showed up one day and I go, I'm done. And I just, like, got go of everything. I said, you have a choice. You could either deal with me bored, in your class for the next 9 months of the school year, or you can let me audit the computer programming course. And they let me take the final exam, and I got to finally take, like, my one programming course in high school. And that's the extent to which I had to go through to be able to take this course. So by that point, I was pretty much, I wanted to do math as a primary, but everyone kept saying you can't do anything with a math degree except for teach. And, I mean, I'm going up in a small town in Mississippi, so I'm like, oh, you know, I want to do computer programming, too, because it's that whole, you know, taking, I always call it the Legos, you know, you're taking, you know what you want at the end, because when you buy the Lego kit, you're buying it because, oh, I want to build the 3,000-piece Imperial Star Destroyer. And then it's just a bunch of just taking, like, the small little pieces and putting them all together over time. You have this incredible, big, complicated structure that wows people, but it's really just a sum of the smaller parts. And so I always loved that aspect for computer programming, computer science, and so that's when I went to college for that. And then started getting into more of, like, research and just doing a lot of research assistant type of work. And then eventually I found the web project, the WebTop, the optics project. I found that, started going to Visual J++, and then I was going to go for a PhD in computer graphics, or at least a master's, but life has a way of happening when you make plans. So I moved out to Seattle. Long story short, I moved out to Seattle, and they told me that day, oh, you're going to interview with Exchange and Visual Studio. I was like, oh, Visual Studio? I actually get to meet the people who are like, write this product, and I knew nothing about software testing, so I actually learned everything, majority of the stuff. I had one topic in one course about how to do software testing. The majority of stuff that I learned going in was from that loop, from the interview loop, because they would say, okay, how would you test this? And the first one I did, they're like, no, you're thinking of a developer, think like a tester, like this. I was like, oh, okay. So the next loop, or the next interview, it's like, okay, how do I try to apply what I learned, and then they would give me some more feedback. And so about the time I got to the Visual Studio team, it's like, okay, I think I understand what they're looking for software testing. They want me to break it. And then when I got here, and they're like, they're explaining the role to me of a tester. And I said, so we raid or we open the bugs, but we don't have to fix them? Mm-hmm. Oh, we do. And they're like, yeah. And I said, so we just test the code, we break the code, we open the bug, and that's it? We go home? And they're like, yeah. I was like, we don't have to fix it. Like, where's the catch? What is it that you're not telling me? It's like, this is too good to be true. And they're like, no, this is what we do. And I was like, it was great for 4.5 years. Yeah, I was like, I can't believe I signed up for this. And they actually, I you're always waiting for that catch, and it never really came. Yeah, I mean, sure, you have to analyze the failures over and over and over, all the test cases are run every single night, but that was like the best moments of my career when they're like, no, you don't have to fix the bugs, you just have to find them. It's like, yes, I just get to break stuff, other people's, you know, software.
Cool. That's that's quite the Tigger collection.
Yeah, my undergraduate advisor, she has a collection of Tiggers, and I worked at Walt Disney World, and so I got some from there. I was a popcorn vendor between
Orlando.
So I have my picture with Mickey Mouse, and then I went back, if you move the hat, I went back just for Tech Ed back in March. Was it Tech Ed? Yeah, Tech Ed in March, or May. And so I have my 10-year reunion with my popcorn wagon, the current vendor.
That's great.
Yeah, so yeah, that's me and Mickey. And then
nice.
I had the popcorn wagon right in front of Cinderella's castle.
So you have a black belt as well?
Yes, I've been doing Shotokan since I was 14.
Okay.
And then we had a world tournament back in October, a team contest. A team competition that we took first place in. That was a lot of training.
That's very cool. Yes. So actually, what I want to talk to you, I want to segue into this other topic, and if Karma, you'll focus on that sign right there. Sarah, what does that say? The Katrina survivor.
Oh, God. So,
can you read that live at the camera?
Katrina survivor, : this box is all that is left of this person's or her family's belongings. Careful. The story there is, and this is actually a cute story, I'm glad you mentioned it, I wasn't going to talk about it, I didn't think about it. When I went to college, one of the friends of the family had, they were like my home away from home, and her mom had babysat me for years upon years, and so they had all of these photos of me as a kid, and they gave me these photos right before I went, like maybe 500 photos right before I moved to college, and I put them away in the shoebox, never thought of them since. Then after Katrina, I realized I happened to discover them again, and like these might be some of the only photos left of me or some of my friends. You know, I don't even know who. And so I'm going through looking for people, and so I went to Kinko's, and I just because it was November of. Was it November that year? It was November the next year, so this is November 2006. And I just went to Kinko's, and I just plopped... I was going to go home for Thanksgiving, and I just plopped this box of photos and said, here's my credit card, I don't care what it costs, I want two sets of copies, and I want them all on CD. And then about 3 weeks later, with that note on top, like, do not touch, do not mess with these photos, I got the sets back, and so it was a Christmas gift to both my mom and the people who gave me the gifts, those photos, because if they would have left it in the house, it would have been completely lost.
So tell us about Katrina and how that touched your family.
Yeah, so should I use my map? Can you, with that?
Yeah, sure. I got it.
You
I
got it.
It.
So my hometown is Waveland. But a local will pronounce it, and this is where the accent
Waveland?
Comes in. Waveland. L-I-N-D, but it's really Waveland. Yeah, this was the center spread for National Geographic a couple months after Katrina. And it's, I was just blown away when I saw it. So this is, yeah, this is literally the beach. This is the central business district. This is my mom's house. It's just off of the map. It's like right there, 0.7 miles from the water. I used to run a lot, so I know all these distances. This is a railroad tracks, which served as an artificial levee because it's about 5-6 feet high, probably a little bit more. But it is kind of like a little levee. This is my elementary school, like my elementary school, my church. The family I was just talking about that had the photos, they live around here. Yeah, I could... Yeah, talk for forever about who lives where.
So all this got flooded?
Oh, completely. 42 feet. The map says 29, but when we measured that city hall, was there for that, they said about 42 feet, because one of the buildings was taller than that. And you can see this is the next day where the storm debris, and this is just storm debris, had come in. It actually flooded 5 miles inland, like 10 feet. And... yeah, my family didn't evacuate, and that was kind of the craziest week of my life, waiting to hear back that they made it. Mm. And, yeah, this is like the city hall, the bank. Anything you see white in this photo, besides the sand, anything that's white is concrete. It was literally concrete slabs. Like, if you notice with the church, there's some red brick to the left, and the rest is white. It was just gone. And, yeah, so this is just the best layout that I can show. And so my mom's house was here. And somehow, my theory is that because our central business district was here, and you had, like, the bank, city hall, the library, you have all these massive big buildings, it created a pocket so that when the water came in, it kind of had, a little bit of a dip here, so they only got 8 feet. But had they been just on the other side of the tracks, they would have had, like, 30 feet of water. And they had an attic, so they were able to get everyone up there. And they took photos and a couple of videos of what was going on at the time. And so, of course, I'm back here in Seattle, and I just happened to, because I blog about everything, that, the East Eyewall, the absolute worst place to be in a hurricane because of the way that the hurricane spin, the East Eyewall is about to make a direct hit to my hometown. I just happened to post it. And it's like... who knows what's about to happen next? Mm. And we'll wait and see. So I'm watching MSNBC.com from my office, just like waiting for any type of news, anything. Still not hearing anything. And that was a Monday. It had come in. Katrina had hit that morning. So Monday goes. Tuesday goes by. It's now Wednesday morning. And still haven't heard anything. And I told my manager, said, if I don't hear anything on Friday, I'm getting on a plane. I'm going home. I'm going to try to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. I had family in Dallas that drove in while Katrina was coming on shore. So they actually made it down there like on Tuesday morning. And they had supplies, and they were able to get to the family. What people don't realize is in New Orleans, yeah, everything flooded. But on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, the water pretty much receded within 5 hours. Some places took an entire day, but it actually kind of just went out. Not like a tsunami effect, but just slowly kind of just went away. So they were able to make it physically to my mom's house the next day. They had to get out chainsaws and cut through some downed trees, but they got there. And so Wednesday morning, it was probably like 2 o'clock in the morning, because, you know, I'm not sleeping too well during this time. We get the email that they made contact. Mm-hmm. They had to, the family from Dallas, they had to drive out to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is about a normal day about 3.5 hours away. I don't even know how many, like 7-8 hours to get over mm-hmm. there. And they had cell phone use, and they were able to make contact. Later that day, so I already know that they survived. And I went to like 24-hour fitness. It's like, must work out, must work out. I'm allowed to freak out now, because I said I wasn't going to freak until I knew something, or it was Friday. So I'm working, I'm coming to work, I'm totally functional. And then I finally found out, and then I was like, okay, I'm freaking out now. But they're okay. So my mom calls me from the beach, 5 miles this way. A single cell phone tower survived. ATF was going around telling everyone to go to the beach, mm-hmm. and to make the call. And so she calls up, and she's like, we're alive! And I was like, yes, I know you're alive. My first comment was, do you know what's happening in New Orleans, Mom? Do you know what's happening? She's like, Sarah, there's not a building standing for miles. She's like, you think we were at a bonfire. There's like 50 people everywhere, all on the cell phone. And you can hear people bleeding through, like, just get out of there. Just get out of there. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Mom. And she's from New Orleans. She's grown up there. The whole family's from there. She knew exactly what I was about to say. It's just like, what's the fastest way I could tell her and explain to her what's going on in the city, what we're seeing on the news for the past, like, 3 days now. Mm-hmm. I'm like, Mom, 17th Street Canal, 300-foot hole. No more water entering the city. 20,000 people trapped at the Superdome. Do you understand what I have just told you? We are witnessing the Armageddon in New Orleans. And I'm like, tell everyone. And of course, she's trying to tell me that they just witnessed the Armageddon on Wavelet. And so we're kind of like fighting like over who's watching a bigger Armageddon or whatever. You know, this is how we are. So got to talk to the family, find out everyone was okay, make that contact. And so what I didn't realize what was happening, and I had to start carrying around a notebook with me, was my blog, because I'm blogging now in this case, day two, haven't heard anything, day three now, my family survived, I've just made first contact with them, whatever. People, there was this weird, interesting thing, and when we initially talked about, like, what do you want me to focus on, and like, blogging and technology. So all the locals are going to, the people down on the coast, they're going to, like, the local newspapers. Mm-hmm. They're going to, like, thesunherald.com. They're going to the local TV stations, like WLOX. You know, trying to, like, they have their own Katrina sites. Now, the rest of the nation and the world, they don't know about, like, these local newspapers. So everyone's setting up their own, like, survivor sites. And so everyone else in the world is going to these survivor sites, and everyone locally is telling the world know that we're alive on these sites. No one was connecting the two. There was no bridging of any of this information. And so my poor little blog, I had just said, you know, Waveland, Katrina. Waveland had like 4,000 people when I grew up. We were at 7,000 right before Katrina. I have now just somehow artificially connected these two worlds. Because anyone who searched any search engine, Waveland, Katrina, any derivation thereof, or even just Waveland, I was the number one site, The Roost Return. I had just gotten on the Visual Studio homepage for the Visual Studio 2005 Tips of the Day, and because we did a series last product cycle around. And so my Google ranking and all my page ranks and things like that went through the roof. Mm. And now here I am blogging about Katrina. Mm. And so this is like artificial, you know, elevation in my blog about Katrina. And so I just started with a notebook, to, like, grabbing down what people were asking, what people in the family were asking, because my mom would call me every morning at, like, 6 a.m. my time. That was the only time she could get out and to call me. And I'm like, okay, these people on my blog are looking for these people. Do you know who I'm talking about? Do you know these people? Or, mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, you don't see them at the beach. Who do you see on the beach? And I will post it to my blog. Let's try it that way. And so I finally had to, like, just stop because it was just madness. It was driving me insane. And I had a post on my blog, look, these are the sites that people are going to back home to report that they're safe. Please, unless I know you, I really can't help you. Or unless you know the person that's physically down there, then yes, I can send my people on the ground to go and find that person. But otherwise, I can't. And then from there, the traffic, like I was getting about 50 emails a day just on, like, do you know so-and-so? It kind of tapered down to, like, 5 or 10. And then I was getting some weird requests, like, I have $100,000 I want to donate. I had just we just did this fundraiser. We wanted to go directly to the town. We don't want to go through FEMA or the Red Cross. We wanted to go to the town. Well, of course, since it's a small town, like the secretary for City Hall, her mother-in-law used to be one of my babysitters who gave me the photo, so, you know, very small town. So I would do all this pre-screening, and if they met certain criteria in my own little head, they got the number to City Hall. But it had to be, like, the real deal and have, like, a lot of money they want to donate, because I wasn't going to, you know, waste City Hall's time, because, you know, they're probably, I can't even imagine what they were going through during the first week, second week after this. They lost every fire department, or every fire vehicle, every cop car, every ambulance. They lost everything. Like, everything was gone.
Wow.
Three doors down had to donate a fire truck, and they donated a bunch of computers. So 6 weeks after the storm, we went down there. I had a fundraiser on my blog about, hey, I'm going down to save Waveland. The Microsoft is, I'll do my best to hook it up with the 5113C and the giving campaign. But for now, we're going to do a little fundraiser, sell donated cookies for $20 a piece. It's how it kind of turned out to be. And I'm going to take that money and bring it down. And then I was asking people, like, on the blogosphere, if you have any other people, any questions, whatever, let me know, because I'm physically going to go down there for 2 weeks. Let me know. And by that time, there were no requests for me to go and find, like, a loved one or a family member. But there were some weird ones about, I have someone's dog. We were fine with having them. Like, there was an elderly couple. They couldn't take the dog with them where they were going, the shelter they were staying at. So they dropped the dog off. We rescued the dog. We just want to know what the dog's name is and if they want to, you know, ever, you know, come back and claim the dog. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of like my quest, is to find this dog's name or to find the owner for this dog. And I knew exactly where they live because from the dog tag, because I rode my bike past that house every day for years. And it was just, like, by that time, there were odd requests. But when I did the Save Waveland campaign, this is not a Microsoft person. This was just someone who read my blog. He took his flexible spending account. This is October. Yeah, this is October now, 3 months after Katrina. He cashed it out on medical supplies. And he just had, like, 6 or 7 bags from Bartels of medical supplies and said, here you go. I mean, just a random reader, never talked to this person before, and here he is, it's just, like, out front of 40, this building, and he's just like, here you go. That was the best thing ever. If I had it all to do over again to go back down there, I would have said, medical supplies. Just go to Bartels, buy like, insect repellent, sunscreen. We can never have enough sunscreen down there, especially right after that, during the summer. You know, we're looking for baby stuff, like any type of like diapers, those were huge. Like, but the medical supplies, those were gone within 2 days. So right here is where they have like one of the major FEMA centers. There were a lot on the highway, but this was one of the big ones that was not on the highway. Probably the only one that might have not been on the highway itself. So it was right at the church, and there was this FEMA vent tent. It was literally spray-painted, FEMA come vent to us. And it was all these trained FEMA workers and some of like the greatest people I've ever met, and really inspired by them. And their job was to go around this town, find what people needed. Because like right here is Vacation Lane, and I met a woman. My dad and I were walking around, and we met this woman who was going through her house for the first time, just chopsticks, just going through, like pickup sticks. Like, looking for things, and she's like, take a picture of me standing, like, in my house, like, sitting with what's left in my house. It's, like, okay, okay, here you go, I'm so sorry, and we walked down the street, and we were looking for more of her furniture, and Red Cross came by, and like, do you want a bottle of water? And he, like, okay, yeah, it's just such disbelief. And like something else, like something that happened to me that really inspired me, what I'm doing right now with like this whole internal evangelist, give out, you know, source code and, you know, all about community enablement, share. So I'm sitting there, and we had just donated like a ton of clothes. Never, ever, ever do clothing for a disaster 2 weeks later. There were so many piles of clothes riding in the street. And we weren't sure to do it or not. And I called my mom. I was like, should we send clothes? And she's like, send everything. And I'm like, I'm hearing reports of clothes riding in the street, Mom. And she's like, send everything. I'm like, okay. And I had to triage clothes, like sort clothes, for the next 11 hours. I will never do anything like that again. I will never do a clothing fundraiser, a fund drive. I cannot, like, reject it enough. Like, don't ever think about doing that. But so we had some clothes, which they wouldn't take here. We finally found a place that took them in Diamond Head, a town about 15 miles away. Like, thank you, thank you, thank you. But here, like, where we had a couple of computers people had donated, and we had some, like, electronics. About this point was, okay, necessities, like, toilet paper, toothbrush, toothpaste, those things have been taken care of. But it's now it's like, it would be great to listen to some music. So I wish I would focus more on that when I was saying, hey, you know, with my fundraiser, of collecting stuff. And so here I am, and I'm sitting on, it's like, here's a concrete slab. Here are the tiles from the church that normally when you stand inside the church, I went to a Catholic school, here are the tiles. And here's, like, the end. And you're literally just sitting there like that. Like, inside, outside. There's just nothing left. And so I'm sitting here, and here's, like, the trailer where they have all these donations. Behind me is the FEMA vent tent. And this woman came up to me and she's like, hey, sir, I know you work at Microsoft because I know family X through friend Y and whatever, small town. And she's like, hey, can you, I got this new computer. And she's all excited about the computer. And it's probably like a Pentium 1 if she's lucky. And I know what's coming next. And she's like, can you put some games on my computer to play in my FEMA trailer? And yeah, I'm just standing there like, I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. Because, okay, first of all, let's forget I'm my even Microsoft employee. It's just, how do I get software, like an operating system for a Pentium 1 in today's world? Mm-hmm. She just wants to play a game, like solitaire, in her FEMA trailer. Mm-hmm. She just got this computer. Now let's say I'm a Microsoft employee. That was like a double whammy because I should be able to somehow. Mm-hmm. Still, do I like try to remember a PID from something somewhere, some Windows product ID, or like what do I do? And I just was, I didn't know what to say. It's like she just wants something to run on the computer, and that. Whatever, what I'm doing at work right now, like the whole open source collaborative development, sharing out sources, doing community enablement, it has the same feel as that moment on the beach. Mm-hmm. Of like, it's just about like having everyone have an equal playing ground or mm-hmm. have the ability to. It doesn't matter like that. I'm a J++ developer in Northern Mississippi. Someone should be able to tell me like, hey, you can talk a tool window. Did you know that? And I should be able to say. To someone somewhere in the world, I'm having this issue with like the current statement. Or where can I go just to get her computer up and running? It's not like we're going to use it for the next 2 years. Definitely not using it for a business. It's just something to pass the time. And so that's a big that feel. So the whole thing I'm doing here in Microsoft, I call it practice, because I feel if I can get very very professional and very very confident in what I'm doing here and sharpen and wet my skills in project coordination mm-hmm. and driving for change and dealing with ambiguity, I can go in some point somewhere in my lifetime when they'd be one of those FEMA event tent people mm-hmm. the people whose job was just to drive around the streets to be the first arrivers on the scene mm-hmm. to say, oh, you know, I just got a whole truckload of fresh fruit and it just came in today, it was not planned. But we have it now. Why don't we just load up a couple of vehicles and drive around and see who's going through their house and mm-hmm. just give them random fresh fruit? True story. And they were saying, like, people were just shocked. Like, you have, like, you know, you have fresh fruit and water, and as I go through the remains of my house, you know, just these little things that brighten people's days. It's sure. like, to tie it back to here, it's like, you know, I'm telling people about a keyboard shortcut. It's like, hey, did you even know how to do this? So there's the similarity. So one day I want to be like our first responder. I want to do something about like everything I'm doing here. It was just a great moment when I was at City Hall and helping them hook up together all their computers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is what I've been training to do. I have found my calling. I just have a little bit more ways to go. I'm not finished with what I'm doing here.
Very cool. So to kind of wrap up and summarize, that bridge that you found with your blog and the technology and this, you know, disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, how does the technology play a role and what did you learn about that?
Well, it's great for communication in something like this. I can't imagine going through this like 5 years ago. It's so fortunate that we have this. Like for my own role, my own personal, I got to share like mm-hmm. Why does anyone here blog? We want to put a human face on what we're doing, you know. Mm-hmm. We want to share about what it's like day in, day out, where our passions are, what we're trying to do, to talk about ourselves. You know, I got to put a very human face on the whole Katrina thing. For what was happening on the ground, what I found fascinating with blogging and websites in general. And that's, I don't know if we could have pulled it off in general, we as in anyone who was using the internet to connect to others back in like even like the late 90s. But something about blogs, people were creating blogs, like my yacht club, my little hometown yacht club, they created a blog just for the members to post. And anyone could post anonymously. Mm-hmm. Or create, I think it was just like they had one entry that said, "Hey, we're here. If you're looking for us, these are the people we have found. If you're a member or you know anyone who is, please post here." And they had like comments. And then it had, of course, like the person who owned the blog who would say updates. Okay, we found this person with this person. But a lot of people were creating blogs just for like, hey, come. Just like people would start searching for, does anyone know about this person, in hopes that the search engine would hit that blog, because they're so easy to create. And I keep thinking about GeoCities, like that was the one I had back in the 90s. You know, that might have taken a while, and you had to know something about HTML. But a blog today, you're up and running. There was a blog where a woman was trying to collect facts just for fighting the insurance companies, because I know a lot of people are familiar with the whole flood versus wind-driven water debacle. And so this woman was using a blog to collect facts, just trying to say, hey, the house to my left, it was wind-driven water. My house was destroyed by a hurricane. House to my right, destroyed by a hurricane. My house was destroyed by a flood. Can anyone help me here? And just posting what she had been going through. So it was very cool to see that. And I think it's just that blogs make it so easy and fast to get your information, your communication out. Whereas a few years ago, you still needed to know something about HTML. But here, everyone, once again, going back to community, everyone has an equal chance to participate. So it was great. Wow. I'm very happy that we had the blog sphere.
It's a fascinating story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So whatever happened with the...
the dog?
The operating system.
And we did find the owner, by the way.
Good. Yeah. So when you mentioned you wanted to find a operating system to run on a Pentium 1,
yeah.
What did you do? You just install Linux on it, or what?
Actually, quite honestly, I was so overwhelmed, I couldn't do anything.
True.
Nothing happened. It was very, very painful for me to say, "I'm sorry, I can't,
yeah.
I can't help," and that hurt. That was a tough one.
Sure.
I try to do a lot of other things, and that's and once again, I hope in the future, like I would love to see like Microsoft have like maybe it's like a disaster recovery kit or something.
Absolutely.
Like just something like, you know, we're gonna see all these Pentium ones and twos.
Yeah.
Can we just have something like a baseline? Even if it's just like a little DOS game, you know, just something. Or, you know, we saw Clearwire actually had at one of the major relief centers on the highway where we actually ate at a soup kitchen every day. That is an interesting experience.
Sure.
You go from here, our lifestyle here and our culture here, and then you go to the receiving end on the soup kitchen line, and you look to your left, and there's a corrugated spray-painted sign that says, "We cannot give you updates on your FEMA trailer status." You talk about a wake-up call in reality of like,
of
wow, we have come so far, and yet, like, we're still leaving so much behind. I would love to see, like Clearwater, you could just go, and you know, I left my business card. I was like, thank you so much for allowing me to continue the blog. I would type all my stuff up night at, you know, in the FEMA trailer I was staying at, and then go and post it on Clearwire, or using their internet that they had set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just love to see something like that. Maybe it's just we take all the old recycled computers today or some of the laptops, like you know, my Pentium 2 that I'm never going to boot again, and we turn them into some type of like, it's like a disaster relief, or maybe it's like the one laptop per child, but scale it to that it's just for a very short time on the ground, just something to get people up and running.
Mm-hmm.
Just a short thing.
That's
or just some
idea.
Type of like this little, I'm just thinking of like this little CD of like you just have, maybe it's a basic functionality of getting, if you can get to the internet, then you're pretty much done. But just like the whole, I just want to play a game. I want to listen
mm-hmm.
to some music. I just want to do something to kill the time. Just it would be awesome to have something like that.
Absolutely.
Cool ideas.
Very cool.
Well, thanks so much for doing this with us.
Thanks for listening to my...
What is your blog site? What is the...
Oh, it's blogs.msdn.com/Sarah Ford. And I'm sure we can put a link to it underneath and have like a link to the category itself for the Katrina stuff.
Excellent.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks you guys for listening to my Katrina stories.
No, it's really incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
Wow.
Cool.
Wow. And that, and you'll have that, you know, record forever. You'll be able to share that with your children or whatever.
Yeah, it's like blogs to create, like, this online record of all time.
That's cool.
Because, like when you're blogging, it's like a moment in time. And there's this weird phenomenon that happens with blogging that when I blog, it's like the snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. And, like, I was posting that I was going to... we had just gotten a dog, and we were looking for a good home for my cockatiel. So that was 2-3 years ago, and I'm still getting emails today. But it's weird how it takes like a snapshot in time, but it also preserves it for historical.
Exactly.
Like something like this, and for this interview, I had to go back and like look at all the things that had happened because it's been a couple years.
Wasn't your family on? What is it, Larry King or
anyone? No, that was crazy. So yeah, during the whole that first couple of months. I get this email from someone claiming to be Brian Williams' producer. And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, is this on the level? So I reply back, and I'm like, yeah, sure. If you want to talk to me, yeah, they were looking for stories. And so so she called me. I'm like, am I really on the phone with Brian Williams' producer? And she asked me, like, you know, about the family and stuff, and, like, why didn't they evacuate? And there were two reasons why everyone didn't evacuate. One was no one knew when Katrina was going to make landfall. They knew it at... Like, Sunday, she made landfall on Monday morning. But, like, Sunday was definitive. It's going to hit. It's going to be catastrophic. Saturday, they still weren't sure where she was going. Mm-hmm. The second thing was Camille, which hit the same exact place, my little hometown, back in 1969, had, like, sustained winds of 220 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. Category 5, worst that could ever possibly happen. The water only came up to those railroad tracks at artificial levee. It didn't even go over. Katrina was only a Category 3 with wind strength, but it had so much water that it actually went 5 miles inland, 10 feet high. You could see it on the interstate where the water marker was, and you're like, this is incredible. So I'm talking to them, like, well, why didn't your family evacuate? And I said, well, they used the house as an emergency shelter during Camille in 69. And her voice changed on the phone, like, really? They were there for Camille. And that's when I knew, like, they kind of had the story.
Right.
And craziest thing I ever saw was October 4th, like, that week, first week in October, is Brian Williams walking through a junkyard with my mom and dad. I'm like, why are they in the junkyard? I mean, it's just piles of rubbish and trash. It's sky high, high as the telephone poles. And it was just concrete slabs everywhere. And I realized, that's my street. That's the street I grew up on. Mm-hmm. And it just blew my mind. Wow. And, yeah, and so Anderson Cooper had interviewed a neighbor. And he was just like me in that position where you find someone seeing their house for the first time as, like, pickup sticks and going through the rubble. Mm-hmm. And he started crying. And, of course, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart was making fun of him, for, you know, because, hey, he's a trained professional. I felt for the guy, but then again, I like The Daily Show. And then they had filmed the week before my parents were about to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, please, Brian Williams, don't cry like Anderson Cooper did to my parents. My family doesn't have to be on The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And so they were re-interviewed just for the 2-year anniversary. And so once again, I'm like, please don't say anything dumb, yeah, my family, or cry Brian Williams. It was the most bizarre thing in my life I've ever said.
That's hilarious.
Very interesting.
Thanks, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you have a Mickey shirt on.
You have a Mickey shirt on. Old school.
She could have sold you popcorn.
But I hide behind a...
Oh, no.
Well, she used to count how many popcorn kernels are, you know, you can do probability analysis on it.
No, popcorn.
How many kernels in a large popcorn barrel?
No, it was questions like, what time is the 3 o'clock parade? How much is a $2 box of popcorn? Well, what time does the 3 o'clock parade get here?
Mm-hmm.
And then... do you have tax? That's how you had to translate.
Nice. Very cool. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks you guys for coming over here.
Yeah.